This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Callie Crossley, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. We especially want to welcome new listeners hearing the program for the first time on KAWC in Yuma, Arizona, WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida, WUIS in Springfield, Illinois, KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri, and WNJZ in Cape May, New Jersey.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
And we begin this hour in Cairo, where more than 40 people have been killed in a shootout today near military barracks in Cairo. The Muslim Brotherhood says its members were staging a sit-in outside the facility, where they believe former President Mohamed Morsi is being held. The army says the group has tried to storm the barracks and call the protesters part of a, quote, terrorist group. Brotherhood members, along with others who support the reinstatement of Morsi, have been staging the sit-in for days. They say they were peaceful and the attack by the army was unprovoked. And some witnesses say the pro-Morsi supporters were performing dawn prayers at the time. Bloody photos and video images appeared on television and social media showing several bodies lying on the ground and doctors and medical personnel attending to the wounded. Earlier today, we spoke to Kristen Chick, Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who just returned from the scene of the shootings.
Well, at this point, the protesters who support President Morsi are in a standoff with the army. They've built a wall sort of out of bricks, and they've been pushed back from the area where the violence took place this morning. But it's still a very tense scene with the protesters standing behind this wall, and on the other side, very close, are army soldiers with APCs who are armed. So it's still a very tense scene.
It sounds so tense that the next step is going to be more violence. It's unclear from your description and what we've seen already, with so much resentment against the army by the Muslim Brotherhood, that that's the only next step, it seems.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood itself insists that they're committed to peaceful protest. But, you know, after what happened today, it's hard to see how this ends quickly and without more violence. The supporters of the president they're in anguish today, with dozens of them having been killed by the army, apparently. And, you know, they're not going to go home. They say they're going to remain peaceful. But, you know, as the protests get bigger, it's really difficult to see where this is going to go.
Well, and they've said they plan to expand the protests beyond the area they're in now. Have they said specifically where they intend to go to expand the protests?
No, they have not said where they're going to go, but the Brotherhood's political party this morning called for an uprising against those who seek to kill your revolution with tanks. So that means, I'm sure, that more and more supporters of the president are going to be coming to the street. That means they're either going to bump into opponents of the president or the military and police. And we don't know yet where they're going to go, but, you know, I certainly see the potential for more violence.
I've read that the army was kind of betwixt and between intervene or to sort of take down the tension, maybe caught in the middle here. But does it matter at this point whether or not the Muslim Brotherhood believes that it was an attack or, in fact, that the army was trying to do something else?
The army made this argument at the beginning, you know, that they are intervening to prevent civil strife. But, you know, what happened this morning, I mean, all of the president's supporters say that they were praying. They were performing the dawn prayer. It was at the end of the dawn prayer that the tear gas and then the gunfire started. So at this point, I don't think it matters what the army says. The supporters of the president are going to see this as a massacre.
Well, if there's a massacre on hand, there seems to be that this would then shut down any potential for at least a political conversation where you could get people around a table to have a discussion, because on the other side, there are more competing protests scheduled to happen as well.
That's absolutely right. This has really complicated the attempts to find a political solution here. Already this morning after the shootings, the Nur party, which is the Salafi, another Islamist party, announced that they were withdrawing from their discussions with the new interim president about forming a new government and appointing a new prime minister. So this is really going to complicate efforts to not only to form a new government, but to get the Muslim Brotherhood to come back to the table and participate in the political process, which is what everyone said they wanted to happen. And that's going to be really difficult now.
So where then does the United States go, walking a delicate line as it has been under the leadership of President Obama, with some like John McCain saying there still is a vacuum in leadership and we need to be a little bit more aggressive on the scene. But with this kind of deadly stalemate, what can happen next?
You know, the U.S. has been pretty constant in, throughout the past 2 years. You know, this isn't the first time that the Army has killed civilians throughout the transition. And in all cases, the U.S. seems to have been pretty cautious, walking a fine line. And, you know, I'm not sure what they're going to do now, but I would expect more of the same.
Thank you so much, Kristen Chick, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, on the ground in Cairo.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, thanks to that popular uprising and a military coup in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi are out, and an interim government is in, and the man tasked with bringing a semblance of stability to an unstable situation is Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court, Adli Mansour. He's been called a mystery man. He's been called an unknown quantity. Now, the idea here is to give Egypt a constitutional redraft and new elections, but Adli's been called a figurehead. Some call him a puppet. But if he's a puppet of whom? Meanwhile, the shreds of a coalition between the clashing sides in Egypt appear to be gone. The conservative Islamist Al-Nur party originally supported the coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, after this weekend's violence, Al-Nur is out, backing away. And that leaves the question, can any one person help unite a decidedly fractured Egypt in the short term? And is that person Adli Mansour? To help answer the question, Mona El-Nagar is a documentary filmmaker and journalist and a former reporter for our partner, The New York Times, in Cairo. And she recently helped profile Adli Mansour for The Times, and she joins me now. Hi, Mona.
Hi.
Adli Mansour, 20 years as Deputy Chief Justice, and he just took over as Chief Justice just as this entire street protest movement was getting underway. He's new even in that position. What do we know about him?
Well, as you said, I mean, he's you know, he's sort of an unknown, a big unknown for people. And this is not abnormal for, you know, someone who's for a judge in Egypt. Basically, most judges in Egypt do not have a very big public profile. They're not necessarily involved in the political or public scene. So this is not unusual that we don't know that much about him. It's also not unusual because people have not called on him to serve as a leader, but just sort of as someone who can really sort of try to help move the country, the political process forward. So he's sort of a transitional figure. It could have been him. It could have been anybody else because he just became Chief Justice, you know, just as these protests were erupting. He finds himself at the forefront of events as a function of the fact that he happened to fill that position. It could have been him. It could have been anybody else. So he's sort of no more than a figurehead at the moment in Egypt. The real arbiter for power is the military institution. And he came to power based on a popular demand, sort of as a transitional step. The protesters were calling on someone to sort of serve as president, as an interim figure, to transition the country and call for an early elections and call for parliamentary elections and form or choose a prime minister who can sort of form a government, a technocrat government that can sort of just move the political process forward.
Well, Adli Mansour may be a figurehead, of course, but he does have enormous power, power to make constitutional declarations in a time of enormous instability. So is there any real sense of somebody who is just a figurehead and isn't really around for the long term, that he may use this power in a way that can bring Egypt towards more stability? Or is he just doing somebody else's bidding?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think that there's any fear that Adli Mansour would try to go for like a full power grab through the, you know, enormous powers that he's just obtained through that position. The idea here is the military is in this precarious situation where, you know, people have gone to the streets in millions, enormous numbers. They have come out and said that we are here to fulfill the people's demands. And the people asked that there be a transitional figure. In this case, it is Adli Mansour, and that it would be his job to sort of call for parliamentary elections, for presidential elections. And there is no real fear that he would sort of act outside of that mission, per se, or try to, you know, have more power than he's meant to have, really. But at the end of the day, Adli Mansour is acting, you know, sort of as a face for what for this transitional moment. He hasn't come out and made any sort of real decisions as of yet. The country, he hasn't chosen a prime minister. There's been talk about the possibility of choosing Mohamed al-Baradei, but that also has been retracted.
That's been so complicated. He was talk about faces. Everybody know, well, not everybody. Mohamed al-Baradei is famous, Nobel Peace Prize winner, weapons inspector, one of the most famous Egyptians in the world. it appeared that he was going to be named prime minister and then retracted. It's a little confusing.
It is confusing because, I mean, basically, again, one of the demands, Mohamed El-Baradei is a very divisive figure. He has a lot of credibility because of who he was, his position outside of Egypt. He hasn't been tarnished, you know, he hasn't come out and done something or said something and sort of lost credibility as a result of not, you know, fulfilling promises. But he's also a divisive figure because he represents a secular force. He's also very popular among the intellectual elite, among secular revolutionary youths. So he doesn't have a huge following necessarily on the street level. And, you know, there's a huge sort of divide between the country's Islamist forces and non-Islamist forces. He's not someone who would represent everybody. He's not a very conciliatory figure. He's not a consensus prime minister per se.
That doesn't explain why they named him in the first place and then retracted
One of the reasons they named him is because he's one of the names that he's sort of he's at the forefront of this non-Islamist movement sort of as a symbol. A lot of people who went down and called to depose ousted President Morsi, they are definitely proponents of Mohamed El-Baradei becoming a leader in the next sort of chapter in Egypt's revolution. However, he's also not a consensus figure. As such, the Noor Party, which is the ultra-conservative Islamists, as soon as they heard the name Mohamed El-Baradei, clearly issued a clear statement saying that they would not basically be engaged in the next part of the political process if Mohamed El-Baradei was in fact named the prime minister. As such, you know, it was kind of withdrawn or sort of the statement was undermined and he retracted essentially. And Mohamed El-Baradei is no longer really, he hasn't been named as prime minister.
The situation in Egypt is fluid, and that is exemplified in what you just heard about Mohamed El-Baradei named prime minister and then retracted, and also in questions about the identity and the intentions of Adli Mansour, the new president, interim president, technocratic president of Egypt. Mona El-Nagar, documentary filmmaker and former reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Todd Zwillick, along with Callie Crossley. Well, the Triborough Bridge in New York City, the Grand Coulee Dam in Washington State, the overseas highway connecting Key West to mainland Florida, these are all products of the New Deal's Public Works Administration, the PWA, which went into effect 80 years ago today, and among those other projects I mentioned, led to the Lincoln Tunnel.
Good afternoon from the Hotel Astor Roof in Times Square. Your city station is about to bring you the after-luncheon ceremonies in connection with the breaking of ground for the third tube of the Lincoln Tunnel connecting New York and New Jersey.
Now, you're listening there to Howard S. Coleman on our co-producer WNYC back in 1952. The PWA broke ground on the Lincoln Tunnel starting in 1935, and it became the driving force of America's biggest construction effort to date. It electrified rural America. It built canals and tunnels, bridges, highway streets, sewage systems, not to mention hospitals and schools and universities.
As I look on Bonneville Dam today, I cannot help the thought that instead of spending, as some nations do, half their national income in piling up armaments and more armaments for purposes of war, we in America are wiser in using our wealth on projects like this, which will give us more wealth, better living, and greater happiness for our children.
FDR there back in 1937. Well, today, the American Society of Civil Engineers, after all of that nostalgia we just heard, gives the United States a D-plus grade on infrastructure. 1 in 9 bridges are structurally unsound, and according to a recent study, air transit ranks 33rd in this country behind places like Panama and Malaysia. And congressional debates over infrastructure funding used to be bipartisan, and now, as you'd guess, they're messy. Ed Rendell is the former Democratic governor of Pennsylvania. He is now founder and co-chair of Building America's Future, advocating for infrastructure spending, and he joins me now. Hi, Governor.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, and it's good of you to join us. You heard a little bit of the history there, and you know about the D+. What is your take on the state of infrastructure in this country? We've heard a lot about not enough spending and crumbling bridges. What is it like from where you sit?
Well, you cited that report that had us 33rd in air transport infrastructure. We're 19th in rails, 22nd in ports. Overall, we've fallen from the World Economic Report. We used to say just 10 years ago we had the number one infrastructure in the world. We're now 14th. Our infrastructure is crumbling. Building America's Future released a report 2 years ago that was called Falling Behind Economically and Falling Apart. The ASCE report makes it clear that our infrastructure is failing in every area and every way. We need to invest more money. The secret of the PWA was it wasn't a program that was welfare. We didn't hire unemployed people per se. The money went to private contractors, either federal or through the states, private contractors to build those roads, those hospitals, those schools, those dams, those levees, the things that were so important to making America the greatest economic power in the world. We don't invest in our infrastructure anymore. It's pitiful. We are barely – we're falling behind on our road construction. As you said, our bridges are in perilous condition. We just saw the bridge in Washington go down. It was structurally deficient, and we're becoming a second-class economic power because we don't have adequate infrastructure.
Former Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania. Governor, the American Society of Civil Engineers, in addition to that D-plus grade that you and I just talked about, estimated an investment by 2020, to bring us up to speed, of $3.6 trillion. And to
well,
that,
I say
good luck. I mean,
well, actually, 1.6, 2 trillion of that is already in the pipeline.
Okay,
that's money the federal government has allocated. The state governments have allocated some private dollars. We need to spend, according to them, 1.6 trillion more in the next 8 years, which is interesting, consistent with the BAF report, which said we needed to spend $200 billion a year more for the next 10 years for our infrastructure. Now, where are we going to get that $200 billion? It doesn't have to be all federal. About 100 or so of it can be state, local, and private. There's a lot of private money that wants to go into infrastructure. But the federal government's going to have to realize that if they want to rebuild our infrastructure, to make us economically competitive, to create jobs, we need to do that. The PWA invested $6 billion over a six-year period. That today would be about $100 billion. And, of course, construction costs back then were minuscule compared to what they are today. But we could do if we invested $100 billion a year more federally each year, that would produce alone 2.5 million well-paying jobs that can't be outsourced, jobs in factories, in steel factories, aggregate factories, asphalt, concrete, jobs on the sites of the bridges and roads and dams and levees and airports that we'd be rebuilding. It's such an obvious thing. If we want to get the economy moving, get manufacturing back, become economically competitive, enhance our public safety and our quality of lives by cutting the time we spend in traffic and congestion, waiting for planes to take off, this is the thing America should be doing now.
Well, Governor, before we let you go, you are an advocate for infrastructure spending now. You're also an old political hand. The highway bill that finally passed in Congress last year hasn't passed since 2005. They got kind of a placeholder bill that only lasted 2 years, not 5 years as normal, because what used to be bipartisan is now a mess. Boy, I bet you wish they still had earmarks in Congress. It would make a lot of this just go a lot easier, wouldn't it?
Right. Earmarks, there were plenty of good earmarks, plenty of bad earmarks. That was the problem, and there was no policing of them. But look, the bottom line is Congress, and this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. There are some Republicans. Jim Inhofe, one of the most conservative Republicans, was the ranking member of the Public Works Commission. He said that the second most important thing the government can spend money on behind defense is infrastructure. We've got to get this done. People of goodwill have to get together. We've got a terrific chairman in the House, Bill Schuster from Pennsylvania. This is something where we have to invest money. It's not spending. It's an investment in our future.
Well, advocates like former Governor Ed Rendell are in long supply on the Republican and Democratic side. Money appears to be in short supply, and political will as well, at least in the Congress.
Political will. You hit it on the head.
That's former Democratic Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania. Thanks, Governor.
Thank you, guys.
Well, following the crash landing of Asiana Flight 214, details are now emerging about what went wrong aboard that Boeing 777 and the errors that may have been made by the flight crew. The 11-hour journey is reported to have gone relatively smoothly as the 291 passengers traveled across the Pacific. That is, until the very last few moments. According to the National Transportation Safety Board, the plane began its descent into San Francisco International Airport too slowly, and the pilots didn't realize it until it was too late. Joining us now with details, the latest details on what may have gone wrong aboard that plane, Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Barbara, I gave a couple of details about what may have gone wrong. It seems as though the pilots didn't have any inkling until literally the last seconds before hitting the runway that something was wrong.
Yes, that is correct. And one thing to keep in mind about this particular investigation is that it should move fairly fast because they have all the information there. They've got the cockpit recorders. Most of the people aboard the plane survived, so their testimony will be very important. Tragically, several were lost, but remarkably, almost all of them got off the plane. So there's going to be a wealth of information, including the crew, and that's really critical. Those crew interviews will be very important. But you're right, they already know that the plane came in far too slowly and that they attempted very late to gain airspeed. But the time to have made that correction was already long past. The pilot, the captain, had essentially let the co-pilot take over for the final approach and landing. And that is fairly common. I know this has come up already in the commentary that there was a rookie pilot, you know, who had never flown this plane into San Francisco before. But that is very common in the industry. And that's partly to give those pilots the experience that they'll ultimately need if they want to take over as captain. So when conditions are very smooth, and that was the case in this particular day, that happens a lot. And that's usually not a problem because this landing should have been by the book.
By the book, and there have also been questions about whether it should have been by computer. There are guided landing systems. Apparently, sometimes they're used, sometimes they aren't. But a lot of questions at the NTSB around if it wasn't being used, why were the pilots aware so very late?
Yes, well, that is, of course, one of the things that they are going to be looking at. And they're also going to be looking at the role of the airport's technology, which part of which was out of commission, apparently, because of construction at the airport. But according to the NTSB statement so far, none of that should have prevented, you know, this from being a perfectly normal landing.
There will be interviews of the flight and of the passengers, Barbara Peterson. A lot of survivors, as you mentioned, and we're all happy about that. What can passengers in interviews bring to an investigation like this?
Well, one of the critical things in determining, you know, how many people can survive a plane crash like this is, of course, how the evacuation is handled. And there are very specific rules about crew training, getting everybody off within 90 seconds. That's the magic number, 90 seconds, because right after that, the plane typically will turn into a fireball. And, of course, you know, that would pretty much eliminate the chances of getting off it. Alive. So airlines prepare for this all the time. However, a couple of the details that we've already heard are somewhat disturbing. For example, a lot of passengers said that they grabbed their carry-ons and got, you know, attempted to bring all their belongings with them off the plane. Typically, they're not supposed to.
They should be getting right off. All right, we're going to stop you right there because we do have to move on. Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler, as the investigation gets underway and more questions emerge about Asiana Flight 214 in San Francisco. Thank you.
Thank you.
In New York City, a once disgraced politician is trying to have a comeback.
I'm asking forgiveness from them for my indiscretions, my violations of trust. I erred. I have acknowledged that. I've said it repeatedly and not shied from it.
Did you think you were going to hear former Congressman Anthony Weiner there? No. Last night, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer announced his candidacy for New York City Comptroller. Spitzer, you will remember, resigned as the governor in 2008 in the midst of a prostitution scandal. And as I just mentioned, he's not the only local candidate with a scandalous past. Former Congressman Anthony Weiner, the Democrat, is running for mayor of New York. And if Spitzer collects enough signatures this week, both of them will be on the 2013 ballot. Governor Spitzer discussed his candidacy on our co-producer WNYC's Brian Lehrer show earlier today. Listen.
Nothing to me has been as rewarding as public service, and I hope the public appreciates that I worked my heart and soul out for them as prosecutor, as attorney general. I think we were significantly ahead of the curve on tough issues.
Brian Lehrer joins us now in studio. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Todd.
I've been your guest so many times. It's nice to turn the tables.
I feel so uncomfortable in the guest chair. I don't know what to do.
Well, what you can do is help us understand how first Anthony Weiner and now Elliot Spitzer, two disgraced public figures, maybe in another jurisdiction in America, would never have a chance at a comeback, are both looking for comebacks in New York City. What's going on here?
I don't think it's anything unique about New York. This could happen anywhere, but it's a coincidence. And you know who really must hate this? Is Anthony Weiner.
Oh, about, yeah.
For those of you who are not in New York, Weiner is leading or tied for first in the polls for mayor, and the media had finally calmed down about his scandal and begun to focus much more on his policies. But I think from now until the election, it'll be, you know, the sex scandal duo. Will one or both get elected? So I think this makes things much worse for Weiner.
For Anthony Weiner. And what about for Elliot Spitzer himself? He won't be the first, if he makes a comeback, he won't be the first politician to do so. But unlike Anthony Weiner, who is a rank and file congressman and running for an executive position, Elliot Spitzer does have a pretty popular track record insofar as he did his job as Attorney General of New York, as governor, the sheriff of Wall Street, and all those things.
Yes, he's got this heft in his background. He's been the governor, as you say. He's been the Attorney General. Sheriff of Wall Street made him very unpopular on Wall Street, very popular with progressives in New York State. But he was not that popular as governor. In fact, I would say that one of the reasons that he had to resign after being caught using prostitutes was that he didn't have any allies, even among the leading Democrats in the New York State legislature, to protect him and say, oh, this is just personal behavior. Forget about it. His governor was already failing politically because he had made so many enemies with his bulldozer style. So he's got a lot of reparation to do.
And as he tries to make a comeback, Elliot Spitzer is reaching for a much lower stepping stone than governor here. What is the comptroller job in New York? Is it something that has any leverage at all?
Well, it does have some leverage. Somewhat politically, because he can do audits of any New York City function. If he wants to make a political point, for example, he used the example with me of New York City high school dropout rates. And so he could audit whether he thinks the education dollars the city is spending are being spent well and become a commentator on education policy in that respect. But you know who else is probably as afraid of this as Anthony Weiner is? Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase,
yeah.
Who Spitzer mentioned by name in our interview, because what does a controller control? He controls the gigantic New York City pension funds. And Spitzer says he would be an activist shareholder and throw his weight around on questions like whether Dimon should be both CEO and chairman of the board.
So a position potentially with some leverage over pensions, over school policy. It really could be what Anthony Weiner, listen to me. It really could be what Elliot Spitzer makes it. And my little gaffe there is part of the point, Brian Lehrer, before we go. If anything, these two guys in the same ballot is going to be a field day for the New York Post headline writers. These two guys separately were great for jokey headlines together, greater than the sum of the parts, I think.
They're already at it, but they may be under the heads of the voters who are ultimately going to have to decide on who's going to make good office holders.
Elliot Spitzer, former governor, trying to make a comeback to be comptroller of New York City. Brian Lehrer is host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Thanks, Brian. New information out on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, also known as the FISA Court. Now, that court operates in secret, approving government surveillance programs, including the two revealed by leaker Edward Snowden. But now we're learning that more than just guiding surveillance programs, the FISA court has vastly expanded the case law, giving the NSA and other agencies the power to listen. In more than a dozen court rulings, the FISA court has granted a vast array of new powers to the NSA to collect data on Americans on issues not just pertaining to terrorism, and here's the thing, also on nuclear proliferation, cyber attacks, and espionage. And the court has ruled that there is a Fourth Amendment exception when it comes to obtaining warrants for searches and seizures to collect and track the communications of Americans. That's new. The NSA says they only collect that information on foreigners, right? Well, Eric Lichtblau is a reporter for the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times, who reported on these broad expansions of the FISA court for the paper. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Eric, you refer in your piece to what has become, or what appears to have become to some, a parallel Supreme Court in the FISA court. What does that mean?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is really the court of last resort and the court of only resort for classified intelligence operations. It operates in secret. Only one side appears, which is the government. There are very few appeals even within the court itself. There is a review court that is also classified, also secret, also with only one party appearing. There's never been a case taken to the Supreme Court because that's so difficult to do. So the upshot is that you have a classified secret court with virtually no public scrutiny that is making, as we're now learning, really broad constitutional case law on surveillance and intelligence operations.
And you talk about an expansion of power, and I want to give one example. You talk about a case where the NSA was able to access an email attachment they thought, in this case, might have details of an Iranian nuclear plant. Now, the thing about that attachment was that it was an American communication. And you refer to this doctrine called special needs. It's not new, but the special needs doctrine was the thing that let the government do drug testing on railway workers because the risk to their privacy was worth the greater protection of the public, or, you know, drunk driving checkpoints because the infringement on privacy of a driver is worth protecting the driving public from drunk drivers. But they've applied this now in a much broader way.
Right, right. The court has taken this special needs doctrine, which, as you say, was established in a railway case in 1989. Probably its most prevalent use, you mentioned drunk driving checkpoints, but airport screenings, that there's an overriding public interest. They've taken that and now applied that in a way that it can be used to justify the collection of all this various metadata, telephone, et cetera, which they ordinarily would not be able to grab, we don't believe, in the vast dragnet effort that they have. But by carving out this exception under the special needs doctrine, they're saying this is still reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, which is the standard reasonableness of search and seizure, because of we're applying the special needs doctrine because there is an overriding public interest. So it's, some would say, lowering the bar. Others would say, you know, changing or adjusting the standards for what is required to make it reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
But boy, Eric, I mean, that sounds like the kind of case that's ripe for review by the Supreme Court. I mean, Congress never intended special needs to apply to a massive pond of metadata of Americans' phone calls and emails that the NSA now has.
You're right. You would think that that would be ripe for appeal. The problem is trying to make that happen when it is such a one-way street in the FISA court and the FISA appeals court as to bringing a challenge. You know, the Supreme Court has never weighed in on these issues. It's been hesitant, really, the last few years to weigh in at all on national security issues. The Bush wiretapping program that really gave way to all these congressional measures, which we saw beginning in 2007 and 2008, the Supreme Court stayed away from that. They ruled that the group that was trying to sue over that, where there was an allegation that the Bush program violated the law, did not have the standing to sue. So I would imagine this would be an even more difficult case to challenge in the appellate courts.
And is it the case also that a lawyer or an organization, even if they found a plaintiff who had standing, whose privacy had been allegedly violated or something, wanted to sue, that because the FISA court and its rulings are secret, that you can't even get your hands on the facts to begin with, to then try to go to the appeals court and get it to the Supreme Court? I mean, it's all kind of murky.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. There have been only a handful of decisions released in redacted form by the court in the 35 years that they've been around. And none of these current rulings that we're talking about that we discussed in Sunday's paper have been released publicly. So you're really kind of litigating in the dark to try and challenge that.
Now, the judges on the FISA court, and there are 11 of them, all appointed by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. There are 11 judges. They rotate in and out. We've heard that before. But they chafe at the criticism that they're a rubber stamp for the surveillance apparatus in this country. But you report that of 1,800 petitions to the court last year, not a single one was denied.
Not a single one was denied. And that's been true for years and years, that virtually no wiretap applications from the government are denied. And that, to be honest, has produced this criticism that it is just a rubber stamp.
I wonder if your sources or people in the intelligence apparatus, whoever they are, seeing that coming and seeing that pressure coming, might have wanted to get this story out there to maybe back those senators off from building public support against the FISA court here.
You know, I don't think that was the timing in terms of our story and the people that I talked to. There's been that pressure, to be honest, for several years, even before the Snowden leaks. The Justice Department and the Obama administration have been pledging for two and a half years now that they were going to try and declassify these rulings. We've had Senate nominees say, yes, we will try and put these out publicly. It hasn't happened. And that pressure has certainly only increased since the Snowden revelations, because now the NSA is back in the news where they don't like to be.
Well, difficult, complicated, and secret, and yet the FISA court appears to be creating a whole new body of case law without the help or the supervision of the United States Supreme Court. That is Eric Lichtblau, reporter in the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times, reporting on the FISA court. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Callie Crossley. Artist Jackie Sumel first heard about Herman Wallace at a lecture on solitary confinement. She was outraged to learn that Wallace, a Louisiana state prisoner, has lived in solitary confinement 23 hours a day for more than 40 years. Herman is believed to be the longest-serving prisoner in solitary confinement in the United States.
I can only make about four steps forward before I touch the door. And if I turn in an about face at any place in this cell, I'm going to bump into something. I'm used to it, and that's one of the bad things about it.
That's Herman describing his solitary confinement cell in a new PBS Point of View documentary, Herman's House, which follows the unlikely and enduring friendship that arises between the two after Jackie started writing to him. Jackie asked Herman, what sort of house does a man who lives in a 6-by-9-foot cell dream of?
In the front of the house, I have three squares of gardens. The gardens are the easiest for me to imagine, and I can see they would be certain to be full of gardenias, carnations, and tulips.
For Herman, it became more than a coping mechanism. He threw himself into the project, and so did Jackie. Filmmaker Angad Bala follows her as she raises awareness of long-term solitary confinement through art exhibitions featuring models of his cell and dream house, and then as she struggles to make Herman's house a reality in the form of a community center in his hometown of New Orleans. Herman's House premieres on July 8th on PBS. Angad and Jackie, welcome.
Thank you for having us, Callie.
Angad, let me start with you. You moved from activism to filmmaker to tell this story. What about this story drew you to take up the camera?
I think this story, just for me, you know, as an activist and as an organizer, we're always looking for ways for people to connect emotionally to an issue. That's generally what ends up driving them to take action and make change. And so I saw that, you know, Jackie and Herman had this really unique friendship that you could emotionally connect to. And so I thought that would be, you know, an interesting way to kind of look at an issue from a very different side. There are plenty of amazing prison documentaries and films that have been made, but I thought what Jackie's project did was it really kind of reframed the whole debate and subject to talk about prisons as living spaces, which they fundamentally are, and not look at them through this lens of crime and punishment. So I just thought there was a really fresh and unique possibility with this film. And I also thought that, you know, I knew Jackie and Jackie was willing to let me into her life. So that, you know, that's another prerequisite for deciding to make a film, having a willing subjects.
At the heart of this, the issue is, as you say, living space, but it's really about solitary confinement. Do you believe it's a form of torture?
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, I think solitary confinement is definitely a form of torture. The UN Special Rapporteur on on torture has said that over 15 days is torture. And we have people, 80,000 people in America are in solitary confinement. We have people in solitary for years on end. And I can't but mention that today in California, thousands of prisoners in solitary confinement are going on hunger strike to protest their conditions and to change the system. And there is, that part of the problem with solitary is that it was designed initially as this kind of timeout period. You'll go spend a few days in solitary to, give you some separation from the rest of the prison population, which, in of itself doesn't seem like a horrible thing. But what we're seeing and what's been happening is that people are being held there for years and years on end. And while 40 years of Herman is definitely an extreme example, that's not to say there aren't people in all over the country who've been in solitary for decades.
Jackie, Herman is still in solitary confinement as we speak?
He is, yeah. He actually is not well right now, so he's in a solitary hospital room. He's locked in a hospital room inside the prison.
And just so that people get a sense of what we mean by 6x9, would you describe the cell that he's in? You actually replicated it. You built it. But, you think 6x9, I think of a rug. So tell me what that space is like.
Yeah, I think most people can think of a 6x9 space. It's almost the exact size of a parking space. A lot of folks have bathrooms that are larger than a 6x9 cell. And this is, as Angad said, what people are relegated to live in for years on end. And within that space is your bed, is a desk, is a small table, is your toilet sink combo. There's a mirror usually in the cells so that inmates have the opportunity to prepare themselves in the mornings or whatever. There's a food slot, so towards the front of the cell, which, is either fully closed in or is, in the case of Herman's cell, has bars on the front. But the actual space that you have to move, to stretch, to pace back and forth is smaller than some cells where we keep animals in the United States. It's really confounding to believe that folks are forced to live in those conditions for years on end.
So, Jackie, we know you're an artist and you got drawn into Herman's dream. It's almost your dream now. This is years later. It's no longer an art project. It's your life. How did Herman's dream become your dream?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how that happened, Kelly. I think you find purpose and meaning in your life and you move in that direction. And that's afforded me a great deal of feeling like my life is whole and meaningful. I'm really grateful for that. There's nothing easy about trying to build the dream home of a man who has been in solitary confinement for over 41 years in the state of Louisiana, but there's purpose to it. And I think I'm really grateful and I'm a really fortunate person for that.
How close are you? Where are you in the process of building the house?
We're in the very beginning stages, but we are actually closer than we've ever been in the sense that I've been meeting with folks here in Louisiana about getting property donated. We have this amazing new media team who have set up and done things that I have no vocabulary to do, which is basically fundraise to set up a fiscal sponsor, to have a website where you can donate to build Herman's house and really just set the foundations to make this shift from a dream house into a reality.
Angad, if there's one thing you want people to take away from your film in terms of the awareness about solitary confinement, what would it be?
It's inhumane and it has to stop. And I think also that it's we are all a part of the society that has allowed it to happen. I think we often think it's very simple to say, oh, there's these bad prison wardens and this, that, and the other. But I think, we've legislated this into practice. It's a reflection on all of us. And so let's acknowledge that and then work together to change it.
Angad Bala, filmmaker, Herman's House, and Jackie Sumel, artist featured in Herman's House. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we always want to hear from you on the show. Be part of our listener response network. You can do it by signing up for our texts. You'll get one text per day where we ask a question featured on the next day's show so that your voice can become part of the on-air conversation. How do you do it? Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Of course, you can give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Callie Crossley.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.